Welcome to World Cafe Words and Music from WXBN. I'm David Dye.
We are very happy today to welcome to the World Cafe a man who's written some of the most beloved songs of the last century. And hey, we'll give him this century a little bit as well. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you know, he's not just in there once, he's in there twice with the Hollies and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And he has written all about it in a new autobiography called Wild Tales. And we are extremely happy to welcome back to the World Cafe, Graham Nash.
Hey.
First of all, you're looking spectacular, young man.
Yeah, I'm only 90.
And you wear it well. Maybe talk at the beginning a little bit about your decision to do this book. I know you'd done the multimedia presentation that had a lot of things about your life in it, and you did it here in Philadelphia.
That's, yeah, it was only done in Philadelphia.
Ah, okay. And so obviously your memory was good. You had all those things in there, and talk about deciding to do this.
I'd been asked many times to do it, especially because of the popularity of David Crosby's autobiography. But I never felt that I was old enough. I mean, you know, I thought you did that kind of stuff when you were 90 or 100 years old, you know. I have three children. They're all in their 30s. They kind of know who I am. They know how I deal with my world. They know how I treat people. But my firstborn son, Jackson, and his partner, Melissa, gave us a beautiful grandchild about a year ago. She was a year old a week ago. I began to realize that at my stage of life, I mean, you know, with all due respect, I could drop dead in the middle of this interview, right? I mean, you know, I've lost friends just as crazily, right? So I was thinking that maybe Stella Joy, which is the name of my granddaughter, would like to know who her grandfather was. And so I did it for my children and for my grandchild. It's very simple. But the great thing about it is now it's out there, it's gone. You know, it's like almost like a song, you know. A song isn't finished in my mind until it's on some kind of, you know, vinyl, CD, DVD, whatever it is that you sell nowadays, or downloads, whatever it is. Once it hits that stage, it's out of my control and it's out of my life. And my life is kind of like that. Now that, you know, this book goes all the way up to the last series of jazz concerts we did with Wynton Marsalis, you know, in May. Now I can get on with the rest of my life and have a great time.
Chapter one.
Yeah.
Indeed. In talking today, I thought we might, heck, let's just do it chronologically, okay? Because there's a lot of interesting things in this book about growing up in Salford and your life there too as well. Maybe describe that a little bit, because it seems like perhaps a typical working class environment, or is that accurate?
I think it was less than working class. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't realize until I read a book on Salford, which is where I come from, which is just a suburb of Manchester in the north of England. It was one of the worst slums in England. Well, we didn't know that. I mean, we had a can to kick around. You know, we were okay. We didn't know how poor we were. I mean, you never do when you, right? You know, nobody has money, so it's not like a big deal. But it was pretty bleak after World War II. You know, goods and services weren't there. You had to have, like, ration books with coupons on it to get bread and milk and butter and stuff. It wasn't easy, you know. But, and you know, 14, 15-year-old kids didn't have a lot to do, right? And then skiffle came along. Skiffle. Do you know what skiffle is?
Now this here's a story about the Rock Island Line. Now Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans.
Skiffle is a form of music that was brought over to England by a man called Lonnie Donegan. And he had visited the United States and hung out with people like Lead Belly and all the blues singers and the folk singers, and brought this very primitive kind of music back to England.
Now we see a train, she's coming down the line. And when she come up near the toll gate, the driver, he shout down to the man. He say, I got pigs, I got horses, I got cows, I got sheep, I got all livestock, I got all livestock, I got all livestock.
The reason why it was so important was not only did the rhythm really attract you, but you could do it. Meaning that if you had a reasonably cheap acoustic guitar Everybody's grandmother had a wash, you know, one of them washboards that they did the washing in, where you'd put thimbles on your fingers and that became the drums. And everybody had a pole with a long piece of string that you could attach to it, you know, a box at the bottom, and that would be the boom, 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 boom. That would be the bass, right? So we could do it.
Down the rock on the line, she's a mighty good road. The rock on the line is a road to ride. The rock on the line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like a fight to get your ticket at the station on the rock on the line.
Well, one of the most momentous things that happened to you, a couple things. You got given a camera, but you met Alan Clark. And tell us how you met him. Alan Clark, of course, the lead singer.
Underappreciated lead singer of the Hollies. I was in school in Mr. Burke's class, and the door opened, and an older lady came with wrapped in a shawl with this young kid. And Mr. Burke went over to the door and started talking to them, and okay, comes back to the class and he says, "Class, this is Harold Clark. He's moving from another district and he's joining this school, and where should he sit?" And fortunately for me, the only vacant seat was right next to me. And so me and Alan became best friends when we were 6 years old. We would sing together. We would, in assembly before school, we'd do the Lord's Prayer, and we would do it in perfect harmony. Mm-hmm. And I began to realize that, you know, this singing thing made me feel good. You know, not a lot of people know that I've been a photographer longer than I've been a musician. In my book, Eye to Eye, of my images, the first portrait in there is of my mother that I took when I was 10, I think. So I've always been this incredibly curious visual person. And the thing is that you couldn't get girls with a camera. You know, they weren't that interested in cameras, but guitars, oh, that's a whole other game, right?
You and Alan had one of those moments where you got to meet the Everly Brothers.
Very important time in my life. April 22nd, 1960, the Everly Brothers come to Manchester to play. And of course, me and Clarky, we were doing Everly, you know, we knew what was going on, right? We decide that we're going to meet the Everly Brothers. Now, we're 18 years old, right? What do we know? We figured that the hotel that they were probably staying at was actually, at the time, the best hotel in Manchester, the Midland Hotel. It was one right where the railway, thing is, where you get off the train and there's this beautiful hotel. So we knew that we were going to probably stay there. And we waited outside in the cold and freezing late evening in Salford for the Everly Brothers to come back to the hotel. And we said to the concierge that was standing there, you know, "Are the Everly Brothers back yet?" And he said, "No, they're not. But this is where they're staying. That's fantastic." So about 1 o'clock in the morning, they come round the corner. They're a little drunk. They've been out to a nightclub after their show that me and Clarkie had just seen. And they stood and talked to me and Alan Clark for a year, but probably only, you know, I don't know, less than a couple of minutes. But it changed my life. There was me and my friend Alan Clark and Don and Phil talking together on the steps of the Midland Hotel. And I never forgot that. And we would say, you know, "What do you do?" "Well, you know, me and my friend, we like sing your songs, and we do skiffle songs, and we want to make music, and we want to get into the business, you know." And they were very encouraging to us. 6 years later, The Hollies were doing a show at the London Palladium in London, and it was like one of them Sunday night shows, like Ed Sullivan, you know, where everyone stays in and watches, you know, this variety show. After soundcheck, we're backstage and the phone rings, and our road manager Rod Shields picks up the phone and yeah, he's right here. Hold on a second. Puts the phone out towards me and he says, "It's Phil Everly." I said, "Yeah, come on, man, come on. This is not nice. No, don't play jokes like that." He goes, "Hey, it's Phil Everly." So I pick up the phone, I go, "Graham here." And he says, "Hey, Graham, it's Phil." And, having learned how to sing with his voice, I knew it was him immediately. He wanted to know if the Hollies had any songs that they could record, that him and Don were in England. They were going to do an album called Two Yanks in England. And did the Hollies have any songs? So, of course, we had songs, you know. We had a lot of songs. So they invited us to their hotel after the show that we did at the London Palladium. And it was the Ritz Hotel, which is kind of a posh hotel in London. And we go up to their suite, and Phil opens the door, and there's Don and Phil, right? You know, and me and Alan Clark, and I think Tony and Bobby were with us, a lead guitar player and drummer from the Hollies. And we sang them their songs that we had. They chose eight of them. And they were recording the next day, and they wanted to know if we would help them sing and help them make the record, you know. And there were some incredible session men in that record. Jimmy Page, this young guitar player, you know, who later became very, very famous, and a piano player called Reggie Dwight, who, of course, became Elton John. So it was very important in my life.
Down the street with my girl, I get a funny feeling when I see you out with my girl.
The next part of that story is I'm in Toledo, Ohio in 1992, I think. And I'm there on a Friday because CSN is playing the show the next day. And the phone rings in the hotel, which is unusual for me. Very few people ever call me. And it was Phil Everly again. And I'm going, "Phil, why are you calling me in Toledo, Ohio? I mean, this is nuts." He says, "Well, you know, your show's tomorrow, but our show is in the same theater tonight. Do you want to come to the show?" So, of course, I want to go to the Everly Brothers show. So me and my friend Mac Olbert, we get on the Everly Brothers bus and we go to the gig. And they do a sound check. And we're eating rubber chicken, which is at 5 o'clock, which is what every rock and roll people do there. And I'm sitting across the table and Don looks at me and he goes, "So, what are you going to sing with us?" I'm dying inside. It's my lifelong dream to sing three-part with the Everly Brothers because that's how I really learned to sing high. So Phil says, "Okay." I say, "Well, I love So Sad. That's really a beautiful song. I mean, we could do So Sad." And he goes, "Okay, well, I'll go underneath Don and you take my part on top, the top part." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I have the top part." I said, "I know, but look who you're talking to. You stay exactly where you are. I will go on top of you vocally." I have a cassette that I just found recently and had restored of me singing So Sad with the Everly Brothers three-part. And please understand, I wanted to kick their ass. You know, I wanted to pay them back for everything that they'd ever taught me, all the beautiful musical moments that I remember. I wanted to be good.
We used to have good times together. But now I feel them slip away. Breaks
the segue here is three-part harmony. And Graham, could you maybe read a little bit of this? Because this is about the first time you sung three-part harmony with a couple of other folks.
Sure. To just set the scene, I had come from Los Angeles to from London to Los Angeles to meet with Joni Mitchell. And I knew that David and Stephen were going to be there because I'd called them when I landed at the airport, right? So this is taking place now in Joni's living room at 8217 Lookout Mountain in Laurel Canyon. I hadn't been there about half hour when David whacked Stephen on the arm and he said, "Hey, play Willie that song we were just doing." Stephen, who was sunk into an armchair next to a giant antique pig from a carousel, uncurled and grabbed his guitar. He finger-picked a few bars of a beautiful intro while David walked over next to him and joined him in the verse. "In the morning when you rise, do you think of me and how you left me crying?" Their harmonies were gorgeous, airtight, two-part, Stephen on the melody with David underneath, that rivaled the Everly Brothers. "Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you've got to be at noon?" I was blown away. The song, "You Don't Have to Cry," was a killer, and their voices double killed it. You hear something like that, you know it's special right away. The words and the tune were perfectly pitched. They got to the end, and I said, "Damn, that's a fabulous song. Man, Stephen, you wrote a beauty there." And I glanced up at Joni, who was sitting by the piano, and I flashed her a smile before asking them, "You want to do that again?" They looked at each other and they shrugged and they said, "Okay." Next time round, I really concentrated on the lyric and the way their voices were intertwining and how they shadowed each other. And hearing them individually, you'd think that they'd sideswipe each other, but they didn't. David's tenor was polished to a high gloss, while Stephen's voice was husky and less disciplined, influenced by bluesy southern roots rock. Somehow they didn't compete as much as complement each other. And they had a natural vibrato which cast a haunting shade. Man, these guys could sing. But so could I. "Okay, bear with me here," I said when they'd finished. "Do it one more time." Three times, same song. They must have thought I was thrown out of my gourd, but I was English and a guest, so they figured, well, let's amuse this guy. Now, I'm a very quick study, so I already knew the words, and I had my harmony down. I'd been listening to it internally and thinking, "I know what to do here. I know where to go there. I got it. I got it." And as Stephen launched into the intro again, I casually made my way over there, standing to his left. And when they hit the opening line, I'm there. I had my breath down. I had the phrasing, the tuning. I put my harmony above Stephen, and off we sailed. "You are living in reality. I left years ago. It quite nearly killed me." What a sound. We were locked in, tight as a drum. Flawless three-part harmony. It sounded so soft and beautiful, so incredible, that a minute or two into the song, we collapsed in laughter, especially when we hit that chorus. It was insane. Wow. Wait a second. What the hell was that?
"In the morning when you rise, do you think of me and how you left me crying? Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality. I left years ago, it quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy, old before your time."
We don't claim any ownership of any of the notes that we sing. You can't sing like me and David and Stephen when we blend our voices together. So whatever the sound that is was born in 40 seconds. We didn't have to rehearse for months or years to get that vocal blend. It happened immediately. And I knew at that moment my life had changed radically, that I would have to go and leave my band and my bank account and my equipment and all the people that I loved and follow this golden sound, because I heard what me and David and Stephen could do, and I wanted it.
And you were also falling in love, which complicated things.
Yeah, well, you know, life is complicated sometimes. But yeah, I was definitely falling in love with you know, someone I consider to be a genius. I think Joni Mitchell is a genius at music. I've never heard anything like that. The very first night I ever met Joan in Ontario in Canada, she sang me, you know, 15 of the greatest songs I'd ever heard in my life. All the songs from her first album, Michael from Mountains, I Had a King, you know, Nathan Lafreniere, all those beautiful, beautiful songs. When she sits you down in front of a fire, you know, and plays you these songs, I mean, you know, what can you do? I mean, you know, I mean, that's just the music side. I mean, look how beautiful Joni Mitchell was, you know. So this combination just took my heart, and I was in love, you know. And that's the way life is.
So I guess the question is why you never married her?
Joni and I had talked about getting married several times, but I'd just been divorced from my first wife. My first wife and I, Rosie, were drifting apart before I ever met Joan. And we were in the process of getting divorced. And it was painful for me, you know. You're supposed to, you know, the path was in the north of England. I'm sure it's pretty much the same here. You know, you get married, you have three kids, you get a real job, and, you know, you live out the rest of your life, you know. But that wasn't my life. And my mother and father made sure that that wasn't my life, and I'll be forever grateful to them for supporting my madness in wanting to go into music in the first place, when you were supposed to do what your dad did and what your grandfather did. And if it was good enough for them, lad, well, it's good enough for you. Get down the mill and go in, you know, go into the mines and, you know. But my mother and father never let me fall for that. So, yeah, I fell in love with Joan, and we had a very serious relationship for several years there.
And some amazing and most amazing song came out of this relationship, and it's one of the most beloved of yours, and it's probably been sung at weddings and anytime couples. It's probably sung at a lot of when people buy a house. what is the story behind our house? Is it all in the lyrics?
Everything's all in the lyrics. I try to be as truthful as possible, and this particular moment was a very ordinary moment in many ways. Joni and I don't know whether you know anything about Los Angeles, but in the Valley there's a very famous deli on Ventura Boulevard called Art's Deli, and it's where you go for breakfast. It's where a lot of people hang out. And Joni and I had been to breakfast at Art's Deli, and when we left, we were walking back to her car and past the small antique store, and obviously, you always look in the window of an antique store. I mean, you know, regardless, right? So she saw a vase there, you know, that holds flowers. And she'd never really spent any money on herself. She wasn't that kind of a woman. But she really liked this vase. And it was only, I don't know, it was only about $100 or something. So she bought the vase, and we go back to her home in the canyon. And get out of the car, and I opening the front door, and I go, you know, I'm gonna, like, it was a gray wind, you know, it's not winter, but it was very gray and very chilly in Los Angeles at the time, and I said, you know, why don't you put some flowers in that vase, and I'll light a fire. And for some reason, it just struck me as an incredibly ordinary moment. I mean, how many times have we said, you know, what, you know, I'll do something while you make dinner, or, you know, when the same way that couples relate. And when she was out there in the garden looking for flowers, she wasn't at the piano, which she mainly was. And while she was getting flowers for the vase, I sat at the piano and turned that incredibly ordinary moment into a song called Our House. Seemed very easy to me, you know. It is a loved song, yes.
Well, let's play it. This is Our House.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love song.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash with Our House. And our guest today is Graham Nash, who has a new autobiography out called Wild Tales. And one of the greatest things for me about this book is your description of your relationship with all the other members of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And you're very, very truthful about it. And it's interesting how the relationships have grown and changed. But there's one that was the strongest, and it's readily apparent, and that is with the man you refer to as Cross, David Crosby. Can you talk a little bit about your bond with him?
David Crosby is one of the most unique people I know. And I know a lot of strange people. But Crosby is something else. The Byrds were in England at one point, and the promoter had made a dreadful mistake because he billed them as America's Beatles. Now, you don't do that in England. You're dead from the start, right? Nobody's the anything Beatles. It's just the Beatles, right? Anyway, he was staying at this this hotel in the north of London, which amazingly, ironically enough, was called the White House. And I called him and I said, you know, you can't smoke dope in the White House. Come on, you know, get out of there. Come and stay with me in my apartment. We'll be able to have a good time. The next day, the Hollies were being were attending a press conference. We had some record in the top five, and people wanted to talk to us. And I asked Cross if he wanted to come along, and he said, sure, let's go. Now, you must understand something about early rock and roll in England. You would do anything for publicity. You would do anything that newspapers wanted and the musical papers. You know, you'd answer any of the silly questions about, you know, who you slept with last night, to what your favorite burger was, to what color your socks are. You know, you'd answer all those stupid questions, you know. This guy comes up to me at the press conference, and he asked me some inane question. And Crosby said, hey. And he swore at the guy. And it was shocking to me that he would treat the press that way. But he said, that's a stupid question. Ask the man a good question here, you know? And I began to realize that you don't have to play that game. You don't have to play that game where photographers have said, okay, there's five of you, so why don't you just put all your heads in a line by this column here, and I'll take your picture of, you know, and put your elbow in your ear, and you know. We would do that because we thought that was the game. But Crosby showed me it was not the game. The game was reality. The game was stop asking these, you know, silly personal questions about who you slept with last night and start asking decent questions. And that was the first time that I really realized that this guy was just totally unique. And he'd played me Guinevere. He'd played me Deja Vu, which is a song that disappears up its own ass. It doesn't repeat. It's not like a normal Moon June, you know, screw me in the back of the car kind of song. It was different than anything I'd heard. And I began to really like David Crosby. And we began a lifelong friendship that has been joyous and incredibly dark at times. David's downward spiral into drugs is well documented, and I tell several stories in the book that are dreadful, and I must confess that my main concern in writing the book was what Cross would think about it, because it's so bleak, some of the things that he did and things he did to himself, and you know, things he put us through, and I had to make sure that he was cool with it, you know. I'll admit something here. The only time that legal from the publishers ever called me was about this one story about David. They said, look, this is so wild. This is so crazy. We have to know that this is true before we publish because, you know, we open ourselves up for lawsuits and stuff. So I called Cross and I said, you know, I told this story about, was it true? And here's the story. David and I had bought Mercedes when we could afford it. You know, it was two long-haired hippies. We go into this Mercedes dealership in San Francisco, and the guy doesn't want us there, don't touch my shiny new cars kind of vibe, you know. So we bought two of them, immediately paid cash and walked out of there. We both cars, right? He sold his car to a dealer for crack. The dealer OD'd. And whilst the body was still in bed, David broke into the dealer's house and stole his pink slip back from the car for the car while the guy was dead. And I said to David, I said, I'm telling this story and I got to know that it's true, that legal want me to really clear this one story. And Cross writes back, he said, I did that. I did put you guys through madness. And by the way, I resold the car for crack. My main concern was how David dealt with it all. But he's a man. He fessed up to what he did. He knows how dark it was. He knows what he put us through. And so he was totally okay with it. And that made me feel a lot better.
Well, here we are in 2013, and there's a lot of that in this book. There's a lot. Drugs are omnipresent in this book. And of course, things are different now, different in your life, different in everybody's life. But it was a problem with everybody. It was a problem with Stephen, and you indicate there was a time when you finally came to terms with certainly the
with our cocaine use?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the problem was that we could afford it. The problem was we could afford as much of it as we wanted. And that's dangerous, as we well know with drugs. They you know, once you start down that path, it, you know, it's a downward spiral. So I haven't taken cocaine since December 9 in 1984. And I remember specifically the day. It was the last show of a CSNY tour, CSN tour, and it ended up at the Kahala Hilton in Honolulu. We had done our last show in Honolulu. And at the end of a tour, you know, you have like a tour party to thank all the crew and, you know, la, 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 you know, how great it was. And I went down to the party and everybody looked as if they were having a great time, but when you really look behind their eyes, they weren't having a great time. They were faking having a great time. And I thought, my God, do I look to them like they look to me right now? And I decided, that's it for me, no more. I have never been, I've taken as many drugs as, when you have drug addicts as friends, there's various ways to deal with it. You know, I took absolutely no drugs. That didn't work. I took as many drugs as David. That didn't work. I tried to do more drugs than David. That didn't work. David only really came back to life when he decided that he'd had enough. You know, when he walked barefoot into the FBI offices in Miami and gave himself up all those years ago, I knew that was a great decision because he had chosen life over death. And I knew that, and I never ever felt that Crosby was going to die. Something in my heart, you know, as screwed up as he used to get, I never thought he would die. And so him and his wife Jan, even though I was brutally honest about them in the book, they came from the darkness out into the light in a really big way, and I'm really thankful. David Crosby is singing as good, if not better, than he ever did.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the and why, because one of the things I love about this book is how you describe Neil Young as kind of mercurial, and your opinion of him in the book does that too. It goes up and down. You have great moments. You have real disappointments, and that's how things remain?
It's just life, isn't it? I mean, they're my brothers. And now, I never had brothers. I had two sisters. So I didn't know what brothers was about. But these guys have been my brothers. I mean, I've known them for almost 50 years, you know. It's like, and you put yourself through madness, you know. Brothers fight and they disagree about lots of stuff. And it's just the same with me and David and Stephen and Neil, you know. But I think that we've always realized that the music is by far the most important part of our relationship. None of this backstabbing and how awfully we've treated each other or how beautifully we've treated each other doesn't make any difference to us. It's the music.
One morning I woke up and I knew you were gone. A new day, a new way. And new eyes to go the way of the mind kept on.
sky is clearing and the night is bright. The sun, he come, the world is all put up. Rejoice, rejoice, we have no choice but to carry on.
Well, okay, Graham, I was thinking, because you've written this book and you've done a bit of thinking about your life, that I would do the Proust questionnaire with you, sort of short answers about parts of your life. I don't know if you know this. It's in the back page of Vanity Fair a lot. This originally started in the late 1800s, and Marcel Proust was the first person to answer these questions. So, you're in distinguished company. So, what is your idea of perfect happiness?
Looking into the eyes of my granddaughter and my children's eyes. That's it for me. Everything else is a game.
What's your greatest fear?
My greatest fear? My greatest fear. How interesting. I'm not a fear guy, but I think my greatest fear might be dying and there's nothing else. I choose to believe in this karmic energy idea where, you know, energy is not destroyed but just changes form and comes back. And I know that once my body rots, you know, some pretty little flowers will appear. But I'd hate to think that this was it. I've got too much to do, you know. It's like,
well, here's something that's a little more earthbound. What's your favorite journey?
My favorite journey. My favorite journey is the one of my self-discovery as to who the hell I am. You know, I don't think a lot about all those kind of things. I kind of get on with every day as we deal with it. I get up in the morning, I realize I'm alive and I'm breathing, and I fully expect the universe to show me something magical every single day, whether it's an idea for a song or whether it's a photograph I'm just taking or a painting that I'm about to complete. I want what's next. I'm not interested in what we've done in the past.
Hmm. What word or phrase do you overuse?
Maybe I'll ask my son, Will. I don't know what phrase I overuse.
Well, there's one in the book that you say a lot, but we can't say it on the radio.
So yeah. You know, the truth is, I wondered about this. You know, I swear a lot. I do. I'll admit it. It's just part of my conversation, the way I talk and relate to people. You know. Yeah. So I asked the publishers. I said, "Are there too many F words in here? You know, because that's the way I talk often." And they said, "No, it just sounds like you talking." So yeah.
It didn't work. What quality do you most like in a woman?
Self-confidence.
What about in a man?
Vision. Hmm. I'll tell you a story. I met my wife Susan. We've been married for 37 years now. When I first met her on one of my first dates, she has this old Karmann Ghia sports car, 1969, and she has it to this day. She doesn't spend money on herself. But anyway, I was on a date with Susan. The top was down. We were driving down this sports car down Sunset Boulevard. Well, I see an incredibly beautiful woman off to the right, standing on the corner. And okay, it was probably a hooker, and I'm hoping it was a woman. But I'm trying to look at this beautiful piece of God's creation here, standing on the corner, and trying, of course, not to let Susan see that I'm trying to look at this beautiful woman. Right? She pulls the car over, slams on the brakes, and says to me, "Don't you ever not look at a beautiful woman if you're going to be with me." It stunned me that a woman was so self-confident that she could say that to me. No woman in my life had ever given me that freedom. We all want to see beautiful people. We all look at beautiful men. We all look at beautiful women, don't we? I mean, come on, let's get real here. And she was the first woman in my life that ever freed me from that kind of, you know, sneaking around trying to look at a beautiful person. Yeah. My wife Susan is something else. I discover more about her every single day.
Well, keep looking at the women, keep being married. Graham Nash, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome, David.
I'm David Dye. World Cafe Words and Music from WXBN is produced at WXBN in Philadelphia. If you'd like to hear more of our World Cafe sessions and get daily cafe alerts, you can sign up at our website at worldcafe.npr.org. As always, thanks for spending your time with the World Cafe.